transcribed.
From Hollywood, NBC brings you Hedda Hopper. With tonight's news brought to life by Agnes Moorhead, Corey Sherry, and Danny Kaye. And here she is, from the desk by the window looking right down on Hollywood and Vine, Hedda Hopper.
Nancy Olsen, Mrs. Alan Lerner, is expecting a baby. Elise and Tom Harmon expect their third child in August. The Leo Gossies' second child is due in May. Leo was a dead-end kid. Wild Bill Wellman, one of our most prolific directors, tells me his wife is anticipating a seventh child. Yes, it's spring, all right. Ingrid Bergman will soon be in the headlines again. Doris Day won't marry Patty Andrews' ex-husband, Martin Melcher, on April the 3rd, as announced. It's been indefinitely postponed. Reason Doris gives is that she's too busy making a picture. Could be that Rita Hayworth and Ollie Kahn are separating, but she says no. But then they said no about their marriage, and they said no again about their baby. Margaret Truman's acting appearance with Jimmy Stewart on radio is a prelude to a picture career. If she clicks on the air, she'll entertain offers from Hollywood. Bing Crosby's sunning himself at Palm Springs, and he's not alone. Bill Murrow's with him. Winston Churchill is trying to make up his mind whether he'll pay another visit to America. Orson Welles is on his way back to America with the belief that people have forgiven him for Macbeth. You know, it's quite a coincidence that Pat Neal was stopping at the same hotel as Gary Cooper in Havana, Cuba. I recently visited with Agnes Moorhead, one of the fabulous first drama quartets, whose leading performance of George Bernard Shaw's Don Juan in Hell has made theatrical history all across the nation. Well, this type of reading performance is nothing new for Agnes. She told me that her interest in it started when she first heard the late Edna St. Vincent Millay read her own poem, The Harp Weaver. And that's my item for tonight, a chance for Agnes Moorhead to read The Harp Weaver.
Son, said my mother when I was knee-high, you need a clothes to cover you, and not a rag have I. There's nothing in the house to make a boy breeches, nor shears to cut a cloth with, nor thread to take stitches. There's nothing in the house but a loaf end of rye, and a harp with a woman's head nobody will buy. And she began to cry. That was in the early fall. When came the late fall, son, she said, the sight of you makes your mother's blood crawl. Little skinny shoulder blades sticking through your clothes, and where you'll get a jacket from, God above knows. It's lucky for me, lad, your daddy's in the ground and can't see the way I let his son go wrong. Oh. And she made a queer sound. That was in the late fall. When the winter came, I'd not a pair of breeches nor a shirt to my name. I couldn't go to school or out of doors to play, and all the other little boys passed our way. Son, said my mother, come climb into my lap, and I'll chase your little bones while you take a nap. Oh, but we were silly for half an hour or more. Me with my long legs dragging on the floor, a rock, rock, rocking to a Mother Goose rhyme. Oh, but we were happy for half an hour's time. But there was I, a great boy, and what would folks say to hear my mother singing me to sleep all day in such a daft way? Men say the winter was bad that year, fuel was scarce and food was dear. A wind with a wolf's head howled about our door, and we burned up the chairs and sat upon the floor. All all that was left us was a chair we couldn't break, and the harp with a woman's head nobody would take, for song or pity's sake. The night before Christmas, I cried with the cold. I cried myself to sleep like a two-year-old. And in the deep night, I felt my mother rise and stare down upon me with love in her eyes. I saw my mother sitting on the one good chair, a light falling on her from, I couldn't tell where, looking 19. And not a day older, and the harp with a woman's head leaned against her shoulder, her thin fingers moving in the thin, tall string, were weaving wonderful things. Many bright threads from where I couldn't see were running through the harp strings rapidly, and gold threads whistling through my mother's hand. I saw the web grow and the pattern expand. She wove a child's jacket, and when it was done, she laid it on the floor and wove another one. She wove a red cloak so regal to see. She's made it for a king's son, I said, and not for me. But I knew it was for me. She wove a pair of breeches quicker than that. She wove a pair of boots and a little cocked hat. She wove a pair of mittens. She wove a little blouse. She wove all night in the still, cold house. She sang as she worked, and the harp string spoke. Her voice never faltered, and the thread never broke. And when I awoke, there sat my mother with the harp against her shoulder, looking 19 and not a day older, a smile about her lips and a light about her head, and her hands in the harp string, frozen, dead. And piled up beside her, and toppling to the skies, were the clothes of a king's son. Just my size.
Thank you, Agnes Moorhead. That was so beautiful. Judy Garland was accompanied to New York by Sid Lusk, but he didn't go to England with her. Lloyds of London are flying a doctor over to examine Errol Flynn's back. They're trying to save that $2,400 a week they've been paying him since his injury. Taylor Mesta will be in San Francisco the end of May to make a speech. I hope she won't choose how to give a party as her subject, because some of the greatest hostesses in the world live in that city. And incidentally, I'm flying to San Francisco on Tuesday to participate in the 58th anniversary of the National Council of Jewish Women. In our town, there's nothing as important as how Hollywood sells itself to the rest of the country. Our publicity. The other night, one of our biggest executives, Dory Sherry, vice president in charge of production at MGM, gave a speech to the independent screen publicists. Dory explained his recipe for improving our town's position in the public eye. He said we writers should soft pedal the scandal and the dirt. Do I agree? I certainly do not.
Now, wait a minute, Hannah. If you were to agree with everything I said, and if I were to agree with everything you said, I probably wouldn't be on this program. However, let's agree to disagree agreeably, and let's first decide what we're going to disagree about. I did not ask that writers soft pedal scandal and dirt. I merely ask that we make an effort to loud pedal the accomplishments and achievements of the industry and of most of the people in it.
Well, isn't that distorting the truth? After all, a reporter's job is to report. And if people insist on getting into trouble...
Wait a minute. If people get into trouble, a moving picture industry council is all for the reporters reporting the incident exactly as it happened. A personality's conduct is his own responsibility. And I certainly would not pretend to ask the press to suppress anything. We only ask that reporters report some of the plus side and not magnify some of the minus side. For instance, if one of our personalities becomes involved in a hit-and-run case or any other crime, then he has broken the law, and that's legitimate bad news. But if he happens to be at a nightclub and is heckled into an argument, I don't think this is the sort of incident that is big enough news to push Korea off the front page.
Well, that's not the same subject, Jory. You're talking about false reports.
Well, that's exactly what I talked about to the publicist. There are many stories that are printed only because of the fame of the people concerned. I don't say that this responsibility is the sole responsibility of the press. Very often, antiquated studio publicity notions create false impressions. America is essentially a moral country, and Hollywood a moral city. We're just anxious to have more people know that.
Well, I'll agree with you on that. But why don't you make more pictures showing just that quality? Intruder in the Dust, for instance, may have been a small segment of the truth about America, but it didn't approach the whole truth. America's also essentially human. We love heroes. We adopt movie stars as our own. We're curious to know everything about them, not just half.
Well, that's exactly my point. You know, there are plenty of good stories that would be colorful and glamorous enough to satisfy all the readers. We happen to believe that people are as interested in reading good things as they are bad.
Or see the good things on the screen as well as the bad.
Well, we know that it's perfectly human to be interested in stories about people's failings and mistakes. But I was told recently by a very prominent publisher of a national magazine that he devotes 16% of his copy to what we call plus news about Hollywood, and his circulation's increased by 1 million. I think that's a pretty good argument from our point of view.
Since we're talking about truth, Dory, how about picture advertising? For instance, take your picture, Battleground.
Mm-hmm.
Denise Darcel had only a bit in that picture, in some of the ads. The public was led to believe that she was more important than she actually was. Why the studio still use that old, stupendous, colossal type of advertising, with every picture advertised as being the greatest, and every movie ad with a girl fully undressed? Wouldn't you say that's the same old, false style of public relations?
Well, now, it would be ridiculous for me to say there have not been big errors in motion picture advertising. But this fault is not unique to the picture business. It's true of all businesses. Everybody uses extravagant terms to praise their own product, whether it's indigestion pills, motor cars, floor polish, cigarettes, or movies.
But these were salesmen, Dory, and obviously not seekers after the truth, as we are.
Well, you certainly have a point, truth in advertising, but let me ask you, how many people would buy the toothpaste that was advertised as, this is a nice toothpaste, smells pretty good, won't cure anything, won't get you married or make you a big success, but it isn't much worse than any of the others, or, this is just another movie, not the greatest, but it should keep you occupied for an hour and 15 minutes.
Well, how many people are buying our pictures today?
About 80 million a week.
Well, I had a letter last week from a small theater owner who said, you know, we bought this theater to support us. We ended up supporting the theater. But you still think that the greatest harm done to our industry is when big names are given unpleasant and often unnecessary publicity?
Well, of course. Generally, I have to say that's so.
Well, what about the headlines regarding communists in Hollywood?
Well, they certainly are big headlines. But I'm not too concerned if what finally emerges is the truth. Because the truth will show that there's a tiny, small percentage of people who are communists. I'm sure no greater than in any other business or any other section of the country. As a matter of fact, only 100 out of 35,000 are under any cloud.
But ours is a peculiar business. You know and I know that we have the greatest medium for disseminating propaganda, good or bad, in the entire world. It's not just another industry. So what do you think about exposing or defending people like Larry Parks and the others?
Well, I believe that those who refuse to cooperate and refuse to answer the committee can solicit no support from the industry. Those who admit that they once were communist members but who have seen the light of day, well, that's up to the American public. The Daily Mirror in New York in an editorial says, Larry Parks has set a pattern for others in Hollywood. Let him have a square deal.
Okay. Now, I'd like to quote what I said in my column in the New York Daily News. 1, 2, or 10 careers in Hollywood aren't worth a dime unless we're willing to lose them for our country. Why so much emphasis on one career? I, for one, believe that the life of one soldier fighting for our freedom is worth more than all the careers in all of Hollywood.
Well, Larry's a public figure. I was going to say that Larry's a public figure, and certainly the public is going to make that decision. In the case of those individuals who were members of organizations that later became communist-controlled, and then got out when they learned that, well, I think they deserve every support.
Yes, if they did get out.
The point is, let's get the truth. And with the truth, I think it is as important that the innocent be protected as it is that the guilty be punished.
Well, Jory, that's why I say we reporters should make public every scrap of evidence we can find. We shouldn't glorify or be soft-hearted about certain quick-change artists who don't sing Yankee Doodle until they're forced to, just one step ahead of the FBI. If, as you say, the actions of a few can blacken our entire industry, then our job is to weed them out just as fast as ever we can.
Well, certainly no one can be against telling the truth about any situation. In connection with that, I should like to say what a man named Meldine has said, and I quote, "In necessary things, unity. In doubtful things, liberty. In all things, charity."
And in an emergency such as we're in now, action. I still argue that it's urgent that these people be classified, and if they are Reds, then eliminated.
Well, I have an abiding faith in truth, and nothing ever stands in the way of it, ultimately and finally.
If we're talking about the truth, then I say the whole problem of publicity, then, is really up to everyone in Hollywood. It's up to the studios and the stars who must live up to their responsibilities.
Of course.
Because they have been so glorified by the American people.
It's up to everyone, even the unglamorous executives, and the writers and columnists who report our town to the world. And that's about where I came in.
And the work has only just begun. We're both for truth and for better public relations. And thank you so much for coming, Doris.
Thank you, Ellie.
Josephine Hull was the biggest hit of all the Academy winners. And the youngest glamour girl, Marlena Dietrich. I was so certain that Jose Ferrer and Judy Holliday would win the two top awards that I offered to bet anybody in Hollywood $1,000 on it. I had no takers. But that doesn't mean I thought they were the best. I don't. Celeste Holm and Sam Jaffe were sitting in the New York Cafe listening to the awards. When Jaffe lost to George Sanders, he said, "Well, that's that." When Celeste lost to Josephine Hull, she turned to Jaffe and said, "Shall we dance?" Richard Bayshaw flew to London without studio permission to pop the $64 question to Valentina Corteva. He came back a sadder and a wiser man. You know, I've always been a great admirer of Maurice Chevalier. I'm also a great fan of Danny Kaye. Well, when I saw 20th Century Fox's brand new picture On the Riviera, I really hit the jackpot. Because in this one, Danny out-chevaliers Chevalier. Listen.
If you look, you see the people from Paris playing on the Riviera. Brambles eyes and snow. It's nice to meet the girl where the moon flood alone is clear. All the girls are gay and they follow France anytime, any place, anyway. If you want another kiss, but you don't think that you should on the Riviera. You would if you're just out to bust out and see what life can give. The place to live is the Riviera. You know, I tell you, why not come with me on the magic carpet of the motion picture to the playground of the world? Nice, which is just a stone's throw from Cannes, which is just a stone's throw from Monte Carlo, which is just a stone's throw from Gibraltar, which is just a stone. As we sail down the Mediterranean, our trip is uneventful, except our cameraman fall overboard. And our director, who I've brought along his parents, develop bad case of mal de mer. He is sick of his mother. We disembark and go immediately to the most famous historic monument of the Riviera, the roulette tables. And it is here we find the croupier, a man with very bad cough. We express to him our sympathies and he exclaims merci, which means thank you. We reply pas de tout, which means father of twins. Not to be confused with pas de deux, father of idiot twins. pronounce do, do, do.
And so we leave beautiful Hawaii and come back to the Riviera, where the ghosts are gay. And they call it Francais any time, any place, any way. If today you have a meeting and tomorrow you broke down the Riviera. Oh, big joke. It was a task to bust up and see what life can give. The task to live in the Riviera. Yeah, you know what I'd like to do, Head? I'd like to come on the show some afternoon and have an argument. You know, I always come on. I'm just a little minstrel boy who sings songs and things. I'd really like to discuss something with you.
Well, I'd like to discuss anything with you. What should we discuss?
Well,
pick your subject.
All right. You know, being engaged in the motion picture business, I feel that those people, not as a group, but definitely, we have, as we sincerely believe...
Oh, definitely.
That I agree with that. If you were misled by advertising and somebody said, go in and see the picture, it doesn't smell bad, and the toothpaste you use will not be, do you honestly think, well, Hedda, I think we're too childish? Seriously, now. You know that in the last 10 years, pictures have really come of age. As far as musicals, I don't know anything about the other ones, but... You remember musical pictures years ago?
I remember them 35 years ago, do you?
Well, goodbye. I remember pictures. When you saw one musical picture, you saw them all, you know? It didn't really matter. You walked in the theater, and if the woman in front did take her hat off, and you did look at the screen, what did you see? Manic Depressive Pictures presents... Wow. Hello, Petra. Produced by Are You Manic? And directed by Depressive. Now you know the name of the picture and you'd like to see it. But no. Screenplay by Glutz, from a stage play by Mutz, from a story by Blitz, from a chapter by Ron, from a sentence by Dokes, from a comma by Stokes, from an idea by Grope, based on Joe Miller's joke. Now you know the name of the picture and who wrote it. And you still like to see it. But now... Direct and finger puff and teary is Minerva but photography. Alarms will take recorded down as needles like a hostery by Zachary, McNackery by Thackeray, Tickery by Dickery, and Dickery by Doc. Now, finally, at last, comes the picture. And what do we see? The same old beautiful chorus girls. The scene is a ranch in Fresno, California. So what are they singing? When it's Jerry Brown's time in all of New Jersey, we'll make a piece of a pair. I know we cantaloupe, so honey, do be mine. And this, up from the ghost rides a hunk of man. Here's our hero, Cowboy Dan, a galloping, yodeling buckaroo. His horse, of course, is a baritone, too. I've got the wagon wheels inside of me. I've got that old captain in the height of me. I've got that. The girls are delighted to hear this. But where is our heroine? As the bell rings for lunch, we find our heroine in the corral, eating her heart out. She is Mary Swann, tap-dancing daughter of an American juggling act who left on the doorstep of an old English castle where she was found by Sir Basil Metabolism, who said, by Jove, a girl did it! I shall raise her as my own daughter! Which he did. But she wants to marry Cowboy Dan, who she fell in love with, so she can tap-dance, but she knows Sir Basil, her father, will never permit this. Never, never, never!
That's why she's eating her heart out.
But through her tears, she is singing a happy little song because she is also a coloratura soprano. She is beside herself.
Her favorite position.
Bar none.
Bar none? Well, that's the password of the FBI. It can't be.
No, you can't be. But it was. You must have to Mary Swann. Mary Swann, you must help me out. Can you tap out a message and hold? This is her big chance. Now she can tap dance, which she does. But what has she done? She has betrayed her own father. But he isn't her father. He is hired by Schubert, my lord, his flogen house, the canary to the hills, and say, I'll be the hills, and say, I'll say, the snail to the hills, and say, I'm the canary to the whole host. Junior. Your hands are dirty, right? And all of a sudden, I was at the man had the FBI finding up with the German spy down in area about his fingers in the pictures of my hand. But no.
Who ever heard of a musical picture without Carmelita Pepita, the Bolivian bombshell? I wish you would come with me to my little village in Bolivia. So peaceful there are the purple mountains with the shining stars and the little sky. And the little people who live so simple and quiet. And every night, all they want to do is
grab a partner, swing away, carry about seven arms and day, grab about teeth and swing about a hair, and you will make a piece of apparel, Dad.
So here we are back in Fresno, California, and this is where you came in. But do not fret, my friend. This is a picture that ends in the middle for the benefit of the people who came in the middle. This is the
God, we still have our Danny Kays, and we still laugh in America. They don't laugh in Russia.
Next week, NBC will again bring you Hedda Hopper with Hollywood News brought to life by the Andrews sisters. A provocative discussion with Richard Carlson and a dramatic highlight with Charles Boyer.
Good night, everybody.
Hear Hedda Hopper next Sunday, right after Phil Harris. And in just a moment, hear Theater Guild starring Walter Pidgeon and Signor Hasso in The Fallen Idol. The Hopper Show is produced by FMB, with direction by Gil Faust, music by Frank Worth. This is Art Baker bidding you good night.
This program is transcribed. Three chimes mean good times on NBC. Coming up next, it's The Fallen Idol, starring Walter Pidgeon and Sidney Hassel on the Theater Guild on the air. And for adventure in the modern-day Wild West, hear Joel McRae tonight as he stars in Tales of the Texas Rangers, authentic stories of the nation's oldest police force. Now, hear The Fallen Idol on Theater Guild on NBC.